Evening, folks. Thank you all for coming tonight. My name is Brady Fisher with Roberts, and on behalf of the Michigan Health Society and our counterparts of the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund, we'd like to thank you for showing up this evening. I get the great honor of introducing our guest speaker. Bruce Friedrich is the Director of Leading Campaigns for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, known as PETA. And his campaigns have been covered by virtually every major newspaper in North America, and he's also a frequent guest on television and radio news programs. Before coming to work for PETA in 1996, Bruce spent 6 years working at a shelter for homeless families and the largest soup kitchen in Washington, D.C. And he graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Grinnell College in Iowa with majors in English and economics and a minor in religious studies. In addition to his work for PETA, Bruce also serves on the governing board of the Catholic Vegetarian Society and the advisory board of the Christian Vegetarian Society. He was also a founding member of the Society of Religious and Ethical Vegetarians. I first met Bruce when I was an intern with PETA in the summer of 1998. And at that time and since then, I've come to know him as a tireless advocate for the marginalized and mistreated members of our society, whether they be human or non-human. He's one of the most dedicated and effective activists that I have the privilege of knowing. And he continually inspires me with his compassion, his optimism, his sense of humor, and above all, his unshakable commitment to social justice. Please join me in giving you a warm Michigan welcome to Bruce Friedrich.
Thank you, that was very sweet. I grew up in Oklahoma, and home of, actually Norman, Oklahoma, home of the Oklahoma Sooners, also a town dominated by football fanatics. In my junior year in my physics class, we had a University of Michigan, somebody who was University of Michigan, alma mater, and for extra credit in physics, he had us memorize the Michigan fight song. So it's one of two fight songs that I know. I know the Sooner song, and I know the University of Michigan song. And there's a fellow who works with PETA. He's a corporate he's our corporate liaison, and he's a former business negotiator. He gives us 30 hours a week. He's been giving us 30 hours a week for about 8 years, and because we couldn't afford him. The PETA salary scale is well below his, but he's committed to the issues, and he's able to make calls to corporate executives in a way that's more effective than any of us who can work for PETA salaries can make calls to corporate executives. And he's an OSU alma mater, and I had no idea that he actually cared about football, but I told him that I was going to the University of Michigan, and he quit. He said, you're going to have to pay me double if you go speak at the University of Michigan. And of course, I agreed, because I wanted to come here, and double zero is still zero. Anyway, I am delighted to be here, although I grew up in Minnesota and then Oklahoma. I live in Virginia now, so I must admit that I didn't find the weather to be hospitable, and I'm not sure why you all did that to me, but it's very, very cold, and being from Virginia, that's it's not okay. I just want you to know that. Did people hear that Bill Gates, this is just sort of an aside, but did people hear that Bill Gates bought the Seattle Times this morning? Yeah, he buys it every morning. All right. Why is monosyllabic such a long word? Who's the jerk who put an S in Lisp? Why is phonics spelled that way? Anyway, I'm just trying to prove Bernie wrong and saying that I have a good sense of humor. Thank you all for turning up. I have been at PETA for 10 years. I've been involved in battling factory farms in one way or another for 18 years. I've been involved in social justice issues for more than 20 years. I first started learning about factory farms a little over 18 years ago when I showed up at Grinnell College, a little granola crunchy school in the cornfields of Iowa, and read a book called Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Moore LePay. Has anybody here read Diet for a Small Planet? Yeah, pretty significant number. That was the book, that book really moved me, and LePay doesn't use the word vegetarian, and she doesn't self-identify as a vegetarian, but she is a vegetarian, and she's a vegetarian for environmental reasons, and she's a vegetarian for human rights reasons. So in talking about factory farming, I'd like to talk about each of these issues, what factory farms do to the environment, what they do to human beings, what they do to our health, and of course what they do to animals. And that was sort of how I learned about these issues as I was studying them 18 years ago. The first thing to say about factory farms and animal product production in general is that it is environmentally catastrophic. Raising corn and wheat and soy and other agricultural products in order to cycle those products through animals is vastly inefficient, so that it takes about 20 calories into an animal to get one calorie back out in the form of meat. It takes 6 to 8 calories into an animal to get one calorie back out in the form of eggs or dairy products. As sort of an example, I weigh about 190 pounds. If I do nothing but lay in bed, I'm going to burn about 2,000 calories a day, you know, watching Jerry Springer reruns. I'll just, you know, veg out, and, you know, every once in a while, Jerry, 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 and then I'll go up to 2,200 calories, you know, prorated. And that's true of agricultural animals as well. The vast majority of what is fed to them, they simply burn existing, so that to raise a chicken for 7 weeks to slaughter that animal for food takes 20 times as many calories in the form of animal feed into the chicken per calorie that you get out of the chicken, or 6 to 8 calories in to get one calorie back out in the form of eggs or dairy products. So who here considers themselves to be an environmentalist? You know, who here cares about the environment, even if you don't self-identify, you're in a, you know, so, okay, who here would go to the refrigerator, open up the refrigerator door, take out 6 to 8 plates of spaghetti and dump them in the trash, and then eat one plate? Okay, one person would, you know, dump 6 to 8 plates, and that's just because it's been in his refrigerator. Thomas keeps the spaghetti there until it turns green and it walks out on its own. But for most of us, we don't do that. So we wouldn't do that. Environmentally speaking, that would be a bad thing to do. But effectively, each time we choose to eat dairy or egg products, that's what we're doing. We're wasting 6 to 8 calories for each calorie that we consume in the form of dairy products or in the form of eggs. Each time we choose to eat chicken or pork or cattle, we are wasting 20 times the resources eating the animal products, cycling all the corn and the soy and the wheat through animals rather than eating that corn or soy or wheat directly. But it's quite a bit worse than that. Think about all the stages of production for getting factory-farmed meat to the table. It is true that raising plant foods is also environmentally intensive, right? I mean, to raise wheat or corn or whatever, you still have to raise it, you still have to till it, you still have to ship that stuff to the, you know, coca roux factory on gas guzzling pollution spewing vehicles. You have to operate the coca roux factory and box up the coca roux and ship them to the grocery store. That is resource intensive, but it's about 4 times as resource intensive to get animal products to the table. You still have to grow the corn or the wheat or the soy or whatever else, which is, of course, takes a lot of water, and those tillers, the combines, are gas guzzling and pollution spewing. You still have to ship that stuff, but now you're shipping it to a feed manufacturing plant on gas guzzling pollution spewing vehicles. You're operating the feed plant, which is resource intensive. You're shipping the feed to the factory farm on gas guzzling pollution spewing vehicles. You're operating the factory farm. You're shipping the animals to slaughterhouses. You're operating the slaughterhouse, etc. It takes about 4 times as much resources to get 4 times as many stages of gas guzzling pollution spewing vehicles and a couple of extra factories to get animal products to the table as opposed to getting vegan products to the table. Factory farming is horrific for our environment. This is a chart, the ratio of natural resources consumption, so that it takes about 20 times the fossil fuels, 14 times as much water, and 25 times as much land to raise animal products as to raise plant-based products. And everything that I've talked about hasn't even gotten to the issue that is of the deepest concern to many environmentalists, and that is all of the waste, all of the excrement that comes out of these factory farms and out of these slaughterhouses. It's polluting our air, it's befouling our water, it's destroying our topsoil, and if you eat animal products, you're responsible for 68,000 pounds of excrement per second. It's 130 times as much waste as the entire human population of this country. This is a fun chart. On the left-hand side is how much excrement farmed animals produce every single second, 68,000 pounds every single second. So, you know, in the course of this lecture, that's an awful lot of animal waste. And vegan foods, that's how much animal excrement vegan foods produce there, the bar on the right. None, of course. From an environmental standpoint, there's a fourth generation cattle rancher by the name of Howard Lyman. He's written a book called Mad Cowboy. He's the guy who got Oprah sued back in the mid-1990s for talking about mad cow disease and the fact that farmed animals are fed the ground up waste parts of other farmed animals. And he has a saying, he says, you can't be a meat eating environmentalist. And I think that's true. This is the reason that I adopted a vegan diet 18 years ago, reading Diet for a Small Planet, was the very simple reason that I consider myself to be an environmentalist, and I don't want to waste resources, I don't want to pollute, and every time I make a dining choice, that's the decision that I'm making. Do I support something that takes 6 to 8 times the resources for dairy and eggs, 20 times the resources for meat, and that produces this kind of waste, this kind of greenhouse gases from all the extra stages of production, or don't I? And I find it empowering to live my environmental values every time I sit down to eat. For me also, I sort of came of age as an activist when I was 14 years old, growing up in Oklahoma. I was playing football, and some of the other football players at my high school and I decided that we would go hear Ronald Reagan speak, and we had our crew cuts and our Young Republican outfits, and we went to hear Ronald Reagan speak, but we brought a banner, and because we looked so the part of the Young Republicans, they ushered us up right to the front, 14-year-old Young Republicans. And then Reagan came out to introduce Don Nichols. Reagan made that mistake, actually, at the time, too, which was just delightful. And we hoisted one another up on our shoulders and pulled out our banner that talked about mining the harbors of Nicaragua, and we got dragged down. We were on the evening news. My parents were so proud. But for me, it had to do with realizing at that point that there were a lot of people suffering in the world. And the area that I first learned about was Central America. But then I came to learn about global poverty. I came to learn about resource distribution and to understand that, as the United Nations says right now, there are 1.3 billion people on the globe living on less than a dollar a day. And there are 800 million people who are currently in what the United Nations calls nutritional deficit. 800 million people in nutritional deficit. What does that mean? Well, it means they're starving to death. You know, nutritional deficit, that's a euphemism. Not taking in enough calories to sustain basic life function. They're starving to death. 800 million people, 1 in 7 human beings on the globe, is starving to death. And 40 million people do every single year, in fact, die from starvation-related causes. It's a humbling statistic for people who would consider ourselves to be human rights activists, as I do, that 1 in 7 people is currently starving to death. Almost 1 in 3 does not have access to water that is not likely to make them sick. 2 billion people do not have access to clean, fresh potable water. And I've been very moved by all of the writings of Gandhi. I think if you listed the 10 most profound things that were ever said, probably 7 of them were said by Gandhi. But one of the more impacting things that he said, think of the face of the poorest person you've ever seen and ask yourself if the action you contemplate will be of use to that person. Think of the face of the poorest person you've ever seen and ask yourself if the action you contemplate will be of use to that person. I think that's a very profound statement for people who attempt to apply the golden rule across the boundaries of space, across the boundaries of nation, and recognize that in the poorest nations, most of those people are wondering where their next meal is coming from. For me, 18 years ago, reading Diet for a Small Planet and learning about resource distribution and learning about the waste of resources that goes into raising animal products and knowing about the issue of global poverty, it seemed unseemly at best that I would continue to consume so gluttonously something that required so many resources while so many people didn't have anything to eat at all. And unfortunately, there is actually a direct relationship there. Throughout the famine in Ethiopia in the mid-1980s, they exported linseed and soy to Europe to feed agricultural animals the entire time. Throughout the famine in Somalia in the early 1990s, they exported, again, linseed and soy to Europe to feed to agricultural animals. The same sort of relationship exists between the United States and Canada and Central and South America. There's a direct relationship between our continuing to eat animal products and starvation and want abroad. Now with things like the World Trade Organization, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, and other global trade agreements, these sorts of relationships are becoming even more repulsive as we continue to use the developing world in these sorts of neo-colonial relationships. The World Watch Institute puts it this way. They say, meat production is an inefficient use of grain. The grain is used more efficiently when consumed directly by humans. Continued growth in meat output is dependent on feeding grain to animals, creating competition for grain between affluent meat eaters and the world's poor. Now, obviously, it's not as easy a relationship as you adopt a vegetarian diet, or you convince your friend to adopt a vegetarian diet, and 20 people in Eritrea suddenly have food to eat. There are socio-political and socio-economic relationships that also need to be fought against. But it is the fact that you are a part of creating a demand for products, cash crops, imports from the developing world, while they don't create enough sustainable crops to feed their own populations. There is a direct relationship there. For me, 18 years ago, this was my introduction to global food supply and the advent of factory farming, and what the advent of factory farming in this country is doing both to our ecosystem as well as to the global poor. And I adopted, because of learning about this, I adopted a vegan diet purely for environmental and human rights reasons 18 years ago. Now, I was also running cross-country at the time. I got into cross-country. I was playing football in Oklahoma, and I got into cross-country to be better at football, and it didn't work. I still sucked at football. And in Oklahoma, if you're bad, they don't have any of this sort of touchy-feely, everybody gets to play mentality. So if you're bad at football, you still get to show up early in the morning and stay after school and get pounded by people who are much bigger than you are. So after some time of getting pounded and pounded and pounded and then sitting on the bench feeling embarrassed as my friends watched me not play, I picked up and quit football. But I kept running cross country because the glory thing about cross country is no matter how bad you are at it, you can letter in it. Anybody else here letter at cross country just because... But were you actually good at it, or you just ran in the back and wore your letter jacket and didn't tell anybody how slow you were? Okay. I was in the back of the pack. I sucked at cross country too. But what I found was when I adopted a vegan diet 18 years ago was that my cross country time went from pathetically slow 47 minutes or so to not quite as pathetically slow 41, 42 minutes as a 10K time. And for people who don't know what that entails, George Bush's 10K time right now at 60 years of age or however old he is, it's like 41 or 42 minutes. So it's slow. But it's also a precipitous drop. It's a drop of more than 10% in the course of about 2 months. And it has to do with the fact that I started working with my physiology rather than working against my physiology. I needed less sleep. I had more energy. I dropped about 10 pounds that I didn't even know I had to lose. And it was because I was doing something that was with my body rather than against my body. You can't see this, I apologize for that, but it's a slide that talks about human physiology compared to herbivore physiology, carnivore physiology, and omnivore physiology. And you can find this slide online on PETA's website, goveg.com, which is our vegetarian website. In the health section, there's a section about are humans natural carnivores, and it has a whole essay on this issue, including this chart. But the long and short of it is that there are about 17 aspects of human physiology that bear everything in common with herbivore physiology and nothing in common with carnivore or omnivore physiology. So that, as just a few examples, every single animal that naturally eats meat has about 10 times the hydrochloric acid in their stomachs that human beings do, so they can start to digest the rotting flesh of raw animal flesh. Every single natural carnivore has a very short digestive tract relative to their body length, about a fourth the length relative to their body length that the human digestive tract is. Every single natural carnivore or omnivore has about 5 times the bone teeth density that human beings do so that they can crunch through the bones of their prey. And the list goes on and on and on as here. This is another one that's intuitive though. If you're walking along and you see a dead animal on the side of the road, probably most people in this room go, oh. Probably most people in society go, ugh. Very few people go, mmm. Right? Anybody in here have the yummy response to roadkill? No, nobody, not even Thomas. And that's because our bodies are designed to tell us, hey, if I eat that, it might kill me, right? We're the only species that has to cook our flesh, the only species that eats flesh, that has to cook the flesh in order for the bacteria on that flesh not to kill us. So however long ago, however long ago we learned, hey, if I cook this, it's not going to kill me. Well, not instantaneously, but in the long run, it still will. According to the American Dietetic Association, working against our physiology by eating animal flesh, scientific data suggests positive relationships between a vegetarian diet and reduced risk for several chronic degenerative diseases and conditions, including obesity, coronary artery disease, hypertension, diabetes, and some types of cancer. The biggest killers in America are heart disease and cancer, number one and number two. And in fact, heart disease kills almost half of us. It kills a little over half of men, almost half of women. And up until about 20 years ago, it was assumed as you got older, if you didn't get hit by a falling piano or leap out of a plane without a parachute, or if something else didn't get you, as you got older, your arteries would clog, and that would give you either a heart attack or a stroke. About 20 years ago, Dean Ornish comes on the scene and proves not just that heart disease is preventable, but that heart disease is reversible. He actually unclogs people's arteries using a low-fat, at that point it was completely vegetarian, now it's completely vegan, diet. He unclogs their arteries and makes them heart attack proof. The average vegan cholesterol level is about 133, the average vegetarian cholesterol is about 160, the average meat-eater cholesterol is about 210. And according to Caldwell Esselstein, a heart scientist at the Cleveland Clinic, if you get your cholesterol level down below 150, you are basically heart attack proof. And of course, he's talking about coronary artery occlusion, which are about 95% of heart disease. There are still some genetic defects that can get you, that would be called a heart attack, but about 95% of them have to do with clogged arteries, and by working with your physiology, you can get your cholesterol level down to such a level at which you are heart attack proof. Medical establishment's response to Ornish's findings and Esselstein's findings and other doctors is to say, it's just too difficult. People won't do it. It's too difficult. To which Ornish says, I don't understand why asking people to eat a well-balanced vegetarian diet is considered drastic. Well, it's medically conservative to cut people open or to put them on powerful cholesterol-lowering drugs for the rest of their lives. And in fact, more and more people are taking Ornish's advice. They're adopting a low-fat vegan diet. And they're not getting heart disease. The number two killer in this country is cancer, of course. And it's interesting how few people recognize that as much cancer is caused by diet as is caused by smoking. It's about 30 to 40% of cancer is caused by smoking. About 30 to 40% of cancer is caused by diet. And T. Colin Campbell at Cornell University, author of the China Study, which is called the Grand Prix of Epidemiological Studies by the New York Times. This guy is probably the foremost epidemiologist in the world. He said, human studies support the carcinogenic effect of animal protein, even at usual levels of consumption. No chemical carcinogen is nearly as important in causing cancer as animal protein. In the study that he did in China, what he found was, starting at zero, the consumption of especially fish flesh and pig meat in China, starting at zero, you could plot it on a graph, and you would see on the graph from zero up to the highest rates of animal product consumption in China for the time that he plotted were a little less than a third the average consumption in the United States. So he would plot it like this for cancer rates, and he traced it to animal protein. And then if those people would emigrate to the United States and start adapting the diet of Americans and the amount of meat consumption of Americans, their cancer rates would skyrocket up to the level of Americans. William Castelli, from Harvard Medical School, a low-fat plant-based diet would not only lower heart attack rate, but by about 85%, it would lower the cancer rate 60%. And then, as everybody knows, we're at epidemic levels of obesity in this country. And again, it has to do with the possibility that factory farming has taken the amount of animal product consumption just skyrocketing. The obesity rate among the general population is about 18%. The overweight percentage among the general population is almost at 70%. Among vegetarians, it's about a third that. Among vegans, it's about a ninth of that. And in fact, vegans weigh on average about 10 to 20 pounds less than meat eaters. The statistics for children also. Children are now at about 25% overweight or obese. Vegetarian children are overweight or obese at about a third that rate. I need to say just a couple of words about the two foods that get far more good press than is warranted, milk and fish. The reason that people, of course, consume milk is that they're told that milk is good for their bones. Dr. John McDougall in the McDougall Program for Women says the myth that osteoporosis is caused by a calcium deficiency was created to sell dairy products and calcium supplements. There's no truth to it. American women are among the biggest consumers of calcium in the world, and they have one of the highest rates of osteoporosis worldwide. In fact, Harvard Medical School found they followed 80,000 nurses for 17 years, and they found that as milk consumption went up among these women, their rates of osteoporosis also went up. Dr. McDougall travels around the country talking about why people should adopt a vegan diet from a purely health standpoint. And in talking about milk, he says, you know, the dairy industry, if they really believed that dairy products were good for your bones, they spend millions of dollars every year on clinical science. Why don't they just do the study that proves it? Feed people extra milk every day for a year or two and find out what happens to their bones. In fact, they did that study back in 1985. They fed women an extra 24 ounces of skim milk every single day for 2 years. For 2 years, 24 ounces of skim milk a day, and they found that the women who consumed the milk had twice the bone deterioration of the women who did not consume the milk. To which McDougall suggests that's probably not a study they're going to repeat anytime soon. And sure enough, it's 21 years later now, and the dairy industry, despite tens of millions of dollars on clinical research, has not done the study that they would do if they believed what it was that they were saying. I would suggest that they know what they're going to find if they do the study, which is why they keep using calcium supplements instead of the full milk package, which comes with animal protein, which is like pouring toxic sludge on your bones, according to one of the dairy industry's own researchers. And this just makes sense. Again, intuitively, we're the only species that consumes the mother's milk of an entirely other species. We're the only species that consumes any mother's milk past the age of weaning. It's not like nature made a mistake. You don't consume cow's mother's milk for your entire lives, and your bones are going to rot. And in fact, the opposite seems to be true. And then the last thing to talk about is fish. It is true that we need omega-3 fatty acids. We can get them from green leafy vegetables. We can get them from walnuts and flax and other vegan foods. If you get them from fish, you will rot your brain. The Chicago Tribune did a three-part front page story just last month. And if you want to read it, we've got it posted on our fishinghurts.com website. Mostly they were looking at government malfeasance. They were measuring tuna and salmon samples that were advertised as being low-toxin tuna and low-toxin commercially raised salmon, and they found that just about all of it had illegal levels of toxic chemicals. Nobody here would go over to the lake, take a glass, dump it into it, put it into the lake, and drink that, because you know what you would get. It would sicken you. But if you're eating fish, you're eating concentrated doses of the mercury and the DDEs and the heavy metals and the lead and all of the toxic stuff that is not water soluble. It collects in the animal's flesh, it collects in the animal's fat, and you end up eating it when you eat fish. The Environmental Protection Agency did a study a couple of years ago. They found that people who eat just one serving of fish a week have measurable decrease in cognitive function. They are measurably less able to remember things that they're told just 30 minutes previously. All animal products work against your physiology, but for a pure issue of how quickly does it adversely affect your health, there's nothing that even comes close to fish. You eat fish, you get the heavy metals, you end up with vertigo, you end up with heavy levels of forgetfulness. Jane Hightower is a Bay Area physician, not actually a researcher, and her patients were coming in more and more and more complaining of forgetfulness and vertigo and dizziness. Yes, vertigo and dizziness. And she traced it back to their fish consumption, and she said, we found that if people eat fish, their mercury goes up. They stop eating fish, their mercury goes down. It's that simple. It's a documented poison. Wherever it's been seen, it's been a problem. The Wall Street Journal, in August of 2005, August of last year, they did a front page piece on fish consumption. And they talked about this kid who went from being an honor student and a jock at his high school. He was eating tuna every day. He was eating a can of tuna a day. And he ended up in remedial learning classes and unable to catch a ball directly as a result of his fish consumption. Obviously, that's a can of tuna a day, but the studies do indicate that eating fish even just once a week will rot your brain. It's also linked to birth defects, cancer, all kinds of problems. We've got on the fishinghurts.com website, we've got citations to all of the original research and all of the original science if you click on health concerns. If you know anybody who is pregnant or anybody who is raising a small child, you will be doing them a big favor by sending them the PDF because, again, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, there are, I can't remember the number, but it's over 100,000 kids who are born with decreased learning capacities as a result of their mothers eating fish. It's especially bad for fetuses. So for me, looking at the environmental effects of factory farming, the human rights, the global starvation effects of factory farming, the health effects of factory farming, all of those reasons caused me to care about the issue. But I didn't get the animal concern and what factory farming was doing to the animals for some years until after I had adopted a vegan diet. When I left college, I went and ran a homeless shelter and a soup kitchen in the inner city in Washington, D.C. for about 6 years. It was the largest soup kitchen in D.C. and then also a shelter for homeless families. My job at the shelter really was just to toss little kids in the air and catch them, and toss them in the air and catch them. When we would go to, like, take the kids to the swimming pool or the playground or something, I didn't count as an adult, but I also didn't count as a child. I couldn't be counted on to supervise, because, you know, all I could really do was throw them in the air and catch them, but they also, I also didn't have to be supervised, and that was really a wonderful, wonderful time. I ended up, after I'd been at the running the shelter in the soup kitchen for about 4 years, I came across a book called Christianity and the Rights of Animals, by an Anglican theologian, professor of theology at Oxford University in England. And in Christianity and the Rights of Animals, the Reverend Andrew Lindsay basically lays out the fact that farmed animals, that these other animals, they're made of flesh and blood and bone, just like human beings. They have the same five senses that we have. They raise their families and are overjoyed to play, and that they're interesting individuals, much in the same way as human beings, and that certainly physiologically they feel pain in the same way that we feel pain, and they feel pain to the same degree that we feel pain. And then Reverend Lindsay goes on to talk about what happens in vivisection laboratories, what happens on factory farms, what happens in slaughterhouses. And that was deeply moving to me, and re-entrenched my veganism. And also caused me to start reevaluating what I was doing with my life. And after a couple of years of thinking about that and talking with people about that, I decided that I wanted to dedicate my life to that. And that was 10 years ago now, and I came to work at PETA, which really is a dream job for anybody who's thinking that they're looking for a new career path. The organization, such a fun group of people, such a motivated, type A, take no prisoners sort of organization, and I really love it. I feel like I hit job lotto. My father sent me some years back, he's a professor at Rutgers, and he sent me this plaque. It says, "Find a job you love, and you'll never have to work a day in your life," which I think is very nice, and I feel like I found that at PETA, and I wish that for all of you. But the argument is pretty basic, and it is that other animals feel pain in the same way that we do, and if we wouldn't do something to a human being, we also shouldn't do it to an animal. Unfortunately, factory farming makes things quite a bit more dire than that. What happens to animals on factory farms, what happens to them in slaughterhouses, is that they have been turned into commodities, basically. And the only question is, how can we make them produce more and faster? And their needs and desires and wants and sentience is entirely discounted. I'm going to show a video. It's called Meet Your Meat. It's narrated by Alec Baldwin. It walks you animal by animal through what happens on factory farms and in slaughterhouses, and all of it is standard agricultural practice. Every time PETA goes undercover on a factory farm, every time we go undercover in a slaughterhouse, we also find sadistic cruelty to animals. None of that is on this video. Everything on the video is legal. Everything on the video is standard. We do have, of course, all of the videos from undercover investigations on the website. If you go to goveg.com, click on videos, you can scroll down to investigations and see what we find every single time we go undercover.
What you are about to see is beyond your worst nightmares. But for animals raised on modern intensive production farms and killed in slaughterhouses, it is cold, inescapable reality. Once you see for yourself the routine cruelty involved in raising animals for food, you'll understand why millions of compassionate people have decided to leave meat off their plates for good. Chickens are probably the most abused animals on the face of the planet. They are crammed into filthy sheds by the tens of thousands, immersed in their own excrement among the corpses of other birds who died of heart attacks or stress. Some even die of starvation brought on by becoming crippled from growing so large, so fast, that their legs can't withstand the weight, which makes them unable to reach food. After being genetically manipulated and fed antibiotics to promote unnaturally rapid growth, their hearts, lungs, and legs often break down under the added weight. Heart attacks and crippling leg deformities are far too common. A PETA investigation found this farmer killing sick and injured turkeys by beating them with a metal rod and then tossing them aside, leaving them still conscious and suffering. This was deemed legal and standard by the industry. These turkeys were left to languish for 6 hours before being loaded back onto another truck to be taken, injured, to the slaughterhouse, another 4 hours from the scene of this accident. This undercover video shows the standard method of gathering chickens for slaughter. After enduring weeks in filthy, crowded conditions, the animals are loaded onto trucks and taken through extreme weather conditions without food or water to slaughterhouses. Where they are snapped into shackles by their fragile legs and have their throats slit, often while still conscious. Many are scalded alive in the feather removal tanks. If you thought it couldn't be any worse, think again. Between 5 and 11 hens are crammed into tiny wire cages during egg production. The animals might go insane from the oppressive conditions and attack one another, so their beaks, which are filled with nerve endings, are painfully seared off with a hot blade. These hens are so crowded that they are unable to spread even one wing during their entire miserable lives. They are unable to do anything natural, such as dust bathing or foraging through the grass. It takes an average of 34 hours in these conditions to produce just one egg. When egg production drops, producers often shock the bodies of the worn-out birds into another laying cycle by withholding food for up to 14 days. Many die of starvation. Because their bones are so weak and their bodies so worn down, up to 90% of hens have broken bones or are hemorrhaging by the time they make it to slaughter. And their horns chopped off and are repeatedly branded, all without painkillers. At auctions, electric prods are used to torment the frightened animals into going where the workers want them to go. USDA allows meat from animals with cancerous lesions and pus-filled wounds to be certified as USDA pure, so injuries and illnesses often go untreated. After enduring close to a year crammed into feedlots, cattle are loaded onto transport trucks and shipped through all weather extremes. At slaughter, their throats are slit open, and many are skinned and dismembered while still fully conscious. Dairy cows have it even worse. Even though they give milk for the same reason that humans do, for their babies, on today's dairy farms, mother cows are treated as nothing more than milk machines. 40% of dairy cows are lame by the time they reach the slaughterhouse. They are hooked up to machines a few times per day, machines that often injure them. At the end of their lives, they are either sent straight to slaughter or are sold for slaughter at cattle auctions. More than 100,000 cows are unable to walk off the transport trucks every year, yet they are slaughtered for human food anyway. At a fraction of their natural lifespan, they're shipped to slaughter. Most hamburger in this country comes from spent dairy cows. Cows give milk for their offspring, not for human beings. These mother cows are impregnated annually to keep the milk flowing, and their babies are torn from them shortly after birth, which causes both of them profound distress. Many of the males are sold to veal farmers, who cram them into tiny crates where they cannot turn around or even comfortably lie down. If you're consuming milk, you're supporting the veal industry. Veal calves who can barely walk because their muscles have atrophied from a lack of use and an anemia-inducing diet are also often sold at auctions. Confined to tiny stalls that don't even allow mother pigs to turn around for most of their pregnancy, the first time that these animals will breathe fresh air is when they are on the back of a truck headed for the slaughterhouse. Many will go insane from the complete lack of stimulation. Shortly after birth, baby pigs have their ears mutilated, the ends of their teeth chopped off, their tails cut off, and they are also castrated, all without any painkillers. Pigs who aren't growing quickly enough, called fall behinds, are killed by being slammed headfirst against the concrete floor, as you see here. Like chickens, pigs grow so quickly that they can't walk normally. Their limbs simply can't sustain their drug-induced bulk. Many pigs become ill or injured, but are not put out of their misery because as long as they're still alive, they have a chance of generating profits for the company if they can make it to slaughter. Those who obviously can't make it to the slaughterhouse are shot with a captive bolt gun so that they don't waste the company's money by eating feed. Moving pigs by beating them with gate rods is one of the more common forms of abuse. Pigs are often packed so tightly together on unventilated trucks that their limbs snap under the weight of other terrified animals, and they sometimes freeze to the sides of the truck or die of dehydration. In fact, 400,000 pigs who are unable to walk off the truck arrive at the slaughterhouses each year. 100,000 arrive dead. These are industry figures. Some speculate that the real numbers are much higher. After being electrically prodded and forced onto the killing floor, improper stunning causes pigs to endure having their throats slit while they are still awake. Some are burned alive in the scalding tank that is used for hair removal. Please think about what you've seen. Every time we sit down to eat, we make a choice. Please choose vegetarianism. Do it for the animals. Do it for the environment. And do it for your health. To find out more, check out PETA's vegetarian website, goveg.com, or call for a free vegetarian starter kit at 1-888-VEG-FOOD. And share this with a friend. Thank you.
I know that's hard to watch, and I'm sorry. The thing to say again is that that's what factory farming does to animals, and remarkably enough, it is all legal. Nothing on that video was anybody prosecuted for. And in fact, each time we've gone undercover, things have been quite a bit worse. We were undercover at a chicken slaughterhouse where they were throwing the animals at walls and jumping up and down on them and spitting tobacco juice in their eyes. We were undercover on two different pig farms where they were skinning the animals alive and mother pigs and raping them with gate rods and beating them senseless just for the sake of beating them senseless. It was pretty hideous cruelty, and it happens again and again and again every time we go undercover and one of these places that there's also sadistic cruelty beyond the economically justifiable and therefore by definition legal cruelty that you watched on that video. PETA is anti-copyright, by the way. Every video that we've got is free for you to use. They're all downloadable on the web. That video is at meat.org. If you go to meat.org, you can download the video or watch the video or send the video to your friends to let them know what factory farming is doing to animals. Chickens, as Alec Baldwin said in the video, they're denied everything that's natural to them. They're bred and they're drugged so that their upper bodies grow almost 7 times as quickly as they did 50 years ago. They're literally in chronic pain for their entire lives. I don't know how many people have been following the recent animal behavior research on chickens, but it's pretty interesting. They have just found, just a couple of months ago, researchers in England announced that chickens have foresight and the capacity to delay gratification, to figure out that if they deny themselves something now, they'll get more of that something later on. It's the first species, other than human beings, that they've found that in. The researchers speculate that certainly there will be other primate species with that capacity and other mammals with that capacity, but it's interesting, to me at least, that the first species they found it in is chickens. Chickens are able to navigate mazes. They're able to figure out that if you're hiding something, that that thing still exists, which human beings, most human beings, are over the age of one before they get to that cognitive level. Chickens can do a variety of things that dogs and cats can't do. Chickens are, in fact, smarter than dogs and cats. And you think about laying hens kept in these cages for their entire lives where they can do nothing that will satisfy their curiosity. They can do nothing that's natural to them. And they feel it every bit as intensely as if it were a dog or a cat in those sorts of conditions. The smartest of the barnyard animals is the pig. Pigs actually do better at playing these video games, and you can watch them doing this in the educational videos section of the GoVeg.com website. They play video games with their snout, they move the joystick, and it's about the cutest thing you've ever seen. And then they show for comparison dogs trying to play the video games with their mouths, and the dogs can't figure out or even come close to figuring out and being task-oriented in the way that the pigs can. Pigs have a cognition level about as advanced as a four-year-old human child in terms of their cognition, their advanced state of being able to do and figure out things that require mental acuity. And mother pigs, as you saw in the video, are crammed into crates for their entire lives where they can't even turn around. They're cooped in their own excrement for their entire lives, and as a result, they go insane. Their bones, their muscles atrophy. Perfectly legal would be felony-level cruelty if we did it to a dog or a cat, but pigs don't feel things any less intensely. Dairy cows, cognition on the level of about dogs and cats. Again, interesting individuals. A herd of cows is very much like a pack of dogs in the way that they relate to one another, and you have the alpha cow. And there was some interesting research, again, out of England, where most of the animal behavior research is being done, although the pig research is being done at the University of Pennsylvania, where the researchers were saying that cows have aha moments when they figure things out. No, they say eureka moments when they figure out the solution to a problem, how to get the food or control their climate or whatever else. And cows, again, cows raised for meat are the only animals who ever get to do anything that's natural to them. They're the only animals who, if you're driving around, you might actually see some cows out in pasture. Are cows raised for meat or cows raised for dairy products? Although the cows raised for dairy products, even on the smaller dairy farms, are now giving, because of genetic manipulation and drugs, 2 to 5 times as much milk as they naturally would, 2 to 5 times as much milk as they were 40 years ago, 10 times as much milk as their babies would naturally suckle. And imagine a human mother giving 10 times as much milk as her babies would naturally suckle. Again, they're in chronic pain for their entire lives as a result. And it's interesting that a third of the dairy herd right now has mastitis, which is a painful udder infection. A third of all cows have mastitis. And by the time they're slaughtered at an average age of about 4.5, 40% of them are lame because they've been giving so much milk that the calcium is sucked out in their milk, and it ends up causing their bones to be very brittle, and they end up lame. About of the 200,000 cows who arrive at slaughterhouses unable to walk off the transport trucks, almost all of them are dairy cows. Very few of them are beef cattle. There's an international milk purity act that governs all of the developed world except the United States that has to do with how much pus can be in milk, somatic cells. And internationally, the legal limit is 250,000 cells. The average in the United States is almost 400,000 pus cells per liter of milk, which is, in addition to being gross, it indicates that according to the dairy industry's own standards, the milk is unhealthful. The dairy industry says if you have 100,000 pus cells per milliliter, so that's 1 million pus cells per liter, I think. But if you have 100,000 pus cells per milliliter, that's an indication that your dairy herd is fine. If you get to 200,000, you've got a problem and you should start looking at it. The average in the United States is almost 400,000. And the only state that meets what is the international standard. The only state below 250,000 pus cells per milliliter is Hawaii, and that's because the cows have mastitis. That's because of factory farming, it's because of intensive production methods, and it's because of drugging up, the drugging up of the animals, and they're, a third of them in chronic pain from the mastitis, and many of them in chronic pain from being lame as well. Fish also, they're just starting to do animal behavior research in fish. And it's pretty interesting stuff, actually. They're determining that fish have long-term memories, that fish can remember where they hid things, they can learn from one another. Fish can use tools, which is kind of interesting. It was not that long ago that anthropologists told us that the thing that distinguished human beings from all other species was our capacity for tool use. And now we're learning that fish, like we already know that other birds and mammals can use tools, but now we're learning that fish also can use tools. The foremost living marine biologist is a woman by the name of Sylvia Earle, and if she were male, her name would be as familiar to you as Jacques Cousteau. Really just an amazing, amazing woman, and she refuses to eat fish. She says, I'd no sooner eat a fish than I'd eat a cocker spaniel. They're interesting, they have personalities, they hurt when they're wounded. And this is a standard method of commercial fish catch. I don't know if you can see, but those are all mouths. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of fish gasping for air after they've been dragged onto the boat of this, onto the deck of this boat, and they will be sliced open and tossed onto ice while they're still fully conscious. These are the lucky ones. These are the ones who, up until they were caught, actually got to be fish. Aqua farming is catching on. About a third of fish now are caught on are raised on aqua farms where they're completely drugged up. They're suffering from sea lice and all kinds of other problems from intensive confinement. 40% on some of these aqua farms die because the conditions are so unbelievably horrific. And we go in detail into both commercial fishing and aqua fishing, as well as all of the stuff that I've been talking about, the science of animal cognition. We have on the GoVeg.com website, if you click on Amazing Animals, we've got all of the peer-reviewed science on animal cognition, and it's pretty fascinating stuff. Pre-fish, none of what I've just talked about even talks about slaughter, where, as Alec Baldwin said in the video, slaughter lines in the United States are moving at many times the rate of the legal limit in Europe, and consequently the animals are oftentimes still conscious when their throats are slit open. The legal maximum slaughter line for cattle in Europe is 75, in the UK it's 60, the average in the US is 400. And our workers are not as well trained. Consequently, oftentimes those animals are still going to be conscious when their throats are slit open. And as this person says, workers can open the legs, the stomach, the neck, cut off the feet, and the cow is still breathing. I would estimate that 1 in 10 cows is still alive when it's bled and skinned. The same sort of thing is true for pigs. The legal maximum rate of pig slaughter in Europe is 300. In the United States, the average rate is 1,100 because of factory farming. And again, our workers are not as well trained. I'm not sure how many people have read Fast Food Nation, but Eric Schlosser looks at turnover rates in slaughterhouses, and it's 300% for the people working on the slaughter line because the job is so unbelievably difficult. The workers are not well trained. They can't keep up with 1,100 pigs or 400 cattle per hour. And finally, chickens. Chickens, there's not even an attempt to render the animals insensible to pain. We have what's called the Humane Slaughter Act in the United States. It's not enforced. It's supposed to be enforced by the USDA, and the USDA took inspectors off the line. They pass something called HACCP, Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point. The inspectors call it have a cup of coffee and pray, as they say that having a cup of coffee and praying would do a better job of ensuring that our meat supply is safe for human beings to consume. But the law does still exist, so there's some sense that the industry is pretending to pay attention to it. But it exempts birds, which means that birds in the United States, they're all still conscious when their throats are slit open. They hit something that immobilizes them, an electrified water, but it does not and was never intended to render them insensible to pain. This is really the scandal, across Europe, that in the United States we turn the voltage down so low that it immobilizes the animals but doesn't render the animals insensible to pain, so that chickens, we eat 9 billion of them every single year. We eat 100 times as many chickens as pigs, 200 times as many chickens as cattle, and all of them are still conscious when their throats are slit open, and then they go into the scalding tank and are literally burned up. So factory farming, what you can do about it. Yes? Okay. What you can do about it comes in two parts. The first thing you can do about it, one of the joys of the vegetarian movement and the animal rights movement, is that it doesn't actually require anything of you to become a member. You can join the animal rights movement, you can join the vegetarian movement at your next meal simply by not paying people to gratuitously abuse animals, simply by choosing to eat a vegan meal. It casts your lot as an environmentalist, it casts your lot as a human rights activist, it casts your lot as somebody who takes your own health seriously, and it says, I don't support cruelty to animals, because every aspect of these animals' lives is categorized by cruelty that would be felony-level illegal if they were covered by the standard animal cruelty laws. Socrates says the unexamined life is not worth living, which I think is a powerful statement. Looking at what happens on factory farms and examining what happens behind a factory farm meal, what we find is if we care at all about the environment, if we care at all about human rights, if we care at all about our own health, and certainly if we care at all about cruelty to animals, the only acceptable response to that, the personal being political, is to refrain from supporting these sorts of products. Every time we as individuals sit down to eat, we can make a choice about who we are in the world. And if we're eating animal products, we're supporting cruelty to animals, we're supporting environmental degradation, we're supporting human misery, and we're doing it all at the expense of our own health. You can challenge yourself to go a couple of steps further as well. Mahatma Gandhi, another powerful quote from him, a person becomes great exactly to the degree to which he works for the welfare of others. We can challenge ourselves to live our lives in a way that doesn't just say, what can I do that will make me happy, or the people immediately around me happy, or my family happy, but what can I do to actually battle back against factory farms? Especially those of you who are in college can take sociology classes to figure out how people think and how we can reach the masses of the public. You can take communication courses. You can go into law, you can go into environmental sciences, you can go into public policy. You can fine-tune your coursework so that you take classes that will make you more effective at actually changing the world. And whatever it was that you were planning to do with your life, I would challenge you, beg you, and encourage you to look at some of the groups that are doing work on these issues. If the environmental issue moves you, you couldn't do better than Waterkeeper Alliance. If the public health issue moves you, the Center for Science and the Public Interest and the Union of Concerned Scientists are doing fantastic work. If the global poverty issue moves you, there are human rights groups, Amnesty International and others, who are working on human rights issues. And of course, if the animal rights issue moves you, there are an array of groups, including People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, the Humane Society of the United States, Farm Sanctuary, and others that are fighting to try to make a difference to battle back against the factory farms. You can make a tremendous difference in your own life simply by refusing to support these products and educating others. You can really make a difference with your life by dedicating your life to battling back against what I think is really one of the great travesties that's going on in the world today with factory farms. I really appreciate all of everybody coming out here on this fine, sunny, warm day to spend an hour or so here, and I would be more than happy to take any questions or comments or castigation or whatever you got. Thank you very much. I do also just want to say real quickly, the website goveg.com has an elaboration with citations on everything that I just said. This was very much the distilled version. So if you go to goveg.com, on the left-hand side, there's environmental issues, health issues, human rights, global poverty, poisoning communities, why the government won't do anything about it. It's all there in detail and with citations. There are also video galleries and photo galleries. We have the best, in my opinion, vegetarian cooking site on the web, which is vegcooking.com. There are menu plans and recipes and all of the great foods that you can eat that you didn't even know were vegetarian. It's all there. It's very exciting.
Should
Brazilian rainforest. Brazilian rainforest being chopped down to grow soy now instead of cattle ranching. Yeah, I mean, because of the free trade agreement, a lot of the cash crops are now being grown in places where they would otherwise have been grazing animals. The thing to remember about the soy that they're growing is that it's being fed to animals. About 80% of all soy grown in the Americas, from South America up, about 80% of all of the soy is fed to farmed animals. So what is not being grazed is still being used to feed farmed animals, because now that they can ship it across the borders more freely, it's becoming economically viable to use Central and South America for feed crops as a cash crop and not just to graze the animals.
So it's not the tofu?
No, it's generally not the tofu you're eating if you're eating organic tofu. There is now, I know there's non-organic soy milk. I think there's also non-organic tofu. But the stuff that's being grown in Central and South America is all feed crop. It's all pesticide-laden, herbicide-laden, and it's all feed crop.
Do you have any suggestions for pet owners for purchasing pet food?
I mean, I know a lot of people who have vegetarian and vegan cats and dogs. Everybody who I know who has attempted to do it with dogs has been successful. Fewer people who have attempted to do it with cats, although some people have done it successfully. There are vegetarian cat and dog foods. With cats, you need to be very careful because they need taurine and some other things. But the people who make the vegan cat foods are careful about that. Farm Sanctuary has a whole section on their website about vegetarian cats and dogs. It's just farmsanctuary.org, and it talks about how to do it safely. It's harder if you have a bunch of cats, because you know if you get one or two cats who refuse to eat it, the other cats will see that and also refuse to eat it. So, I mean, one of the things that is true is that veganism is an ethic of compassion, and it's not a list of ingredients, and so we do the best that we can. We can all eat vegan very, very easily. Some cats can't, and it's just unfortunately the way it is. Yeah, I mean, I guess I do sometimes use vegetarianism and veganism somewhat interchangeably in talking about the benefits, because the benefits are the same. The benefits of going vegan are just the same plus. I think the environmental argument is the strongest one for moving from vegetarian to vegan, just because, as I said at the beginning, veganism still takes a sixth to an eighth the resources per meal of non-veganism. It still takes 6 to 8 times the resources fed to an animal to get a dairy product calorie or to get an egg calorie. But all of the arguments are the same. If you're talking about the environment, if you're talking about global poverty, those crops are being fed to agricultural animals, dairy cows and egg-laying hens just as much as the meat animals. The health benefits are the same. I mean, from a health standpoint, dairy and fish are probably the two that are really going to screw you up the worst. And from an animal standpoint, the animals are still treated like machines. Eggs are the cruelest. Battery-caged eggs are the animals who are denied more than any of the other animals, and 99% of eggs come from battery-caged hens, and that's what you saw in the video where Alec Baldwin says, if you thought it couldn't get any worse, think again, and that's sure enough true. From a cruelty standpoint, the products to give up, you know, beef would be the product to give up last rather than the product to give up first. Dairy, you would certainly give up before giving up beef. And I mean, for me, it's just empowering when I sit down to eat not to support, as much as I can avoid it, cruelty to animals. And it is still the case that a vegan, you're tilling up, some animals are killed in the tilling process, some animals are killed by the pesticides and the herbicides that are dumped on the crops. But by being a vegan, you save 6 to 8 times as many of those animals by eating the products directly rather than by feeding them to farmed animals so you can eat dairy or eggs. Because again, the vast majority of what we grow, the vast majority of those animals who die in the tillers, the vast majority of the animals who die from eating pesticide or herbicide crops, those crops are fed to animals. So you just save so many more animals by adopting a vegan diet as opposed to a vegetarian diet. It's just the next step. Does anybody, you know, one of the things that I'd be interested in is if anybody here eats meat and would like to talk about why they eat meat, I would be very interested. I know it could be, it's a lot to ask if you do and you want to talk about it, but I found it very interesting. I have a t-shirt that says, "Ask me why I'm vegan," and I have a button on my jacket that says, "Ask me why I'm vegan," and I've started, when people do ask, and I get asked probably once or twice per outing with the shirt or the button, I've given a quick, "Well, this is why I'm vegan, you know, do you eat meat?" And they say, "Yes, well, why?" And it's interesting, and I think that it's a more effective way of having the conversation where you challenge people to look at their own view and to challenge themselves about the degree to which that is living with integrity for them. But does anybody, is anybody willing to have that conversation? Does anybody else have questions or comments or anything else? Well, one of the things that we're very excited about right now with the World Wide Web is the capacity to reach people with online advertising. So we're now online advertising our meat.org, the Meet Your Meat video, as well as two other videos that we have, one of them Pamela Anderson against KFC and the other one the Reverend Al Sharpton against KFC. Because we think that watching the video is the thing that is going to be more effective than anything else. We're also sponsoring a lot of keywords and trying to drive traffic to our websites. That's what we're trying to do to reach people as effectively as possible through online stuff. We continue to do the stuff that offends people or annoys people or whatever else to try to get attention simultaneously, because you know I can sit here and we talk with 65 people in a serious presentation, but if we do something where I'd rather go naked than wear fur, or we put people in coffins and say payback time, bird flu kills, or whatever, we can reach millions of people, and a significant portion of those people go to the website and they get the information, and we don't have the budget of our adversaries, so. We tend to do sort of everything that we can think of to get people's attention. Anybody else?
How much outreach does Peter do with supermarkets and restaurants and other businesses?
We do. How much outreach do we do with supermarkets and restaurants, et cetera? We do a lot of outreach. I mean, we're constantly in contact with all of the largest grocery chains and fast food chains and everybody else. Principally, we're focused on trying to change some of the factory farming processes through the major corporations. Although we are responsible for Burger King having a BK veggie, we did just negotiate with Johnny Rockets to offer a 2-for-1 on Meat Out veggie burger, which we're excited about. We're gonna try to get Burger King to do that now as well. And we are, we are in constant contact with the executives at all of the major corporations. That's what Steve Gross, the fellow who I mentioned earlier, who was so upset that I was coming to the University of Michigan, he is a professional business negotiator. That's what he does with corporations, and he gives us about 30 hours a week calling corporations and investment companies and trying to get the corporations to institute some standards or to at the very least get rid of some of the worst abuses of animals on factory farms. And in fact, it's Steve's work with PETA that is the reason hens are no longer force molted. Up until, I guess, about 4 years ago, all laying hens were starved for 2 weeks to shock their bodies into another laying cycle. About 1/5 of the animals died, but the other 4/5, their bodies were shocked and they went into another laying cycle. And we had a campaign against McDonald's, forced McDonald's to change, then Burger King, then Wendy's, then Safeway. And then the entire industry changed as a direct result of the work of corporations. So we're trying right now, we're working on chicken slaughter. We've succeeded in getting 1.5 million birds a week slaughtered in a way that has gone from the worst to the best. When you look at the fact that 9 billion birds are slaughtered every year, 1.5 million a week is very close to nothing, but for those 1.5 million, it's significant. And our hope is in the next couple of years, we'll be able to transform the way that, birds are slaughtered. We're also simultaneously working with them on increasing the amount of vegan options that they offer or vegetarian options that they offer. And kind of, it's a full frontal assault. And we just got another volunteer. A PETA major donor has just decided that she wants to help out in this regard as well. So, and she's a CEO of a .com in San Francisco. So hopefully we'll be able to be even more effective in this area using both Steve and this other woman, using their contacts and their prestige to make at least some inroads. Going from vegetarian to vegan, basic steps that you can take. I guess getting the information. I went 18 years ago, I went vegetarian, and then like 2 months later, I went vegan, and didn't find it that difficult. But we do have a Making the Transitions page on vegcooking.com that gives like a 2-week menu plan and lots of the products that you can look for. I'm not a fan of label reading. I like what Vegan Outreach is promoting now, visual veganism. If it appears to be vegan, don't sweat the less than 2% stuff, which I think simultaneously makes it easier to be vegan and makes our advocacy that much more effective. What it is a fact that everything that we eat causes some suffering, and if we turn veganism into an ingredient list, it seems to me that it marginalizes us, and it might be good for us and our personal purity, but for people who are trying to influence, they might think about vegetarianism, which would save 100 animals a year, but because you send the veggie burger back because of the less than 2% dairy product, whey in the bun, they no longer consider it because it just seems so difficult. You have just gotten, 1/1,000,000,000th of an animal suffering out of your bun. Makes you feel very, very good, except that you've just cost 100 animals their lives by the person who might otherwise have considered the issue. I go sort of more in depth into this issue in an essay online, but I do think as you're transitioning from vegetarianism to veganism, you should focus on the obvious dairy products, the obvious egg products, before you move on to examining the ingredient list on everything you buy.
Is there a place where you can find like all the essential nutrients your body needs and then like vegan options that can give you those nutrients?
Yeah, mostly what you do when you go from especially meat eater to vegan is you get rid of stuff that you don't need. You get rid of cholesterol, you cut down on saturated fat. The one thing that you need as a vegan that you don't get in animal products is vitamin B12. That you don't get in vegan products is vitamin B12. And the reason that you don't get vitamin B12 in vegan products, you would naturally get it as a vegan in your water. You would naturally get it in organic fruits and vegetables. But now we've so destroyed our topsoil and we dose our water with chlorine and fluoride so that we kill the B12 in it. B12 cultivates in bacteria. So because meat has bacteria, because dairy products have bacteria, you still get the B12 and the bacteria in those animal products. But you can just take a B12 supplement. Most vegans eat soy milk that's fortified with it, breakfast cereal that's fortified with it. And you need such a micro amount that you're unlikely to have a deficiency until you've been vegan for a long time. I don't actually take a B12 supplement. I've been vegan for 18 years. I got my B12 tested like 3 years ago, I guess, and I had a very high level without supplementing. Although, if you eat mostly natural foods, you might want to take a supplement every now and then. All right, thank you all very much. I want to let people go, but I'll hang out up here and chat with people for as long as you want to hang out and chat. But everybody else, thank you very, very much for coming. And if anybody has further questions, just pop up.